And of course, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatimi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Qul in صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran says it is ready to resume talks on the 2015 nuclear deal, but it is doubtful about the seriousness of the U.S. to return to the JCPOA. Two Canadians imprisoned in China released after Huawei's chief financial officer holding Canada on U.S. fraud charges was freed. Also, the U.S. empties a camp hosting thousands of refugees in Texas amid growing criticism over the mistreatment of the asylum seekers. Welcome to your world news coming to you live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you for joining us. Beginning with our top story, Iran says it is ready to resume talks on the 2015 nuclear deal, but is doubtful about the seriousness of the United States to return to the accord. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the comment as he met his French counterpart, Jean-Yves Le Drian, in New York on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly. Amir Abdullahian said the U.S. has taken a serious and practical step to resume compliance with the deal known as the JCPOA. He said, however, the U.S. is rapidly reviewing the minutes, or Iran is rapidly reviewing the minutes of the talks held in Vienna with JCPOA parties since April in order to restart negotiations. The top diplomat stressed that Tehran needs to see tangible results from any talks aimed at reviving the pact that Washington unilaterally left 3 years ago. Lodorian said Paris is worried about delays in continuation of the Vienna talks and wants them to resume as soon as possible. India and Pakistan have traded jabs at the annual session of the United Nations General Assembly, accusing each other of harboring extremists. Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan accused his Indian counterpart Narendra Modi of, quote, a reign of terror on Muslims and planning to purge India of them. Khan said the worst form of Islamophobia now rules India. The comments came as India has witnessed a number of anti-Muslim riots perpetrated by the ruling party allied extremist Hindu outfits. Modi has also rescinded the statehood of the disputed Muslim majority region of Kashmir and pushed through a citizenship law that critics call discriminatory against Muslims. Meanwhile, the first secretary at India's UN mission accused Pakistan of sheltering Al-Qaeda mastermind Osama bin Laden, who was killed back in 2011. She also accused Pakistan of nurturing terrorists. Palestinians have gathered near the Red Cross headquarters in the Gaza Strip to voice solidarity with Palestinian inmates languishing in Israeli jails. Ruba Shabit has more.
Islamic and national factions in the Gaza Strip held a protest in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails who are under hunger strike and are subjected to Israeli abuse. The event that included Friday prayer in front of the Red Cross headquarters came a day after an ex-prisoner, Hussein Masalma, died of cancer after being detained for 19 years.
We are here in front of the Red Cross to remind the international human rights organizations of their role to protect our prisoners inside Israeli jails and who are under solitary confinement. There are six prisoners under hunger strike protesting the inhumane Israeli abuse against them and the illegal administrative detention. This is not the only medical negligence of hundreds of our prisoners, but an international killing practiced by the Israeli regime.
Al-Masalma's medical condition deteriorated due to complications resulting from Israeli medical negligence and torture at the time he was in custody that led to his inevitable slow death.
There is no doubt that Palestinian detainees are witnessing tough measures and abuse inside the Israeli jails, especially following the escape operation. Yesterday, Al-Masalma succumbed to his cancer that deteriorated while being in jail. There are more than hundreds of inmates who have lost their lives in Israeli jails due to intentional medical negligence.
Palestinian factions say they won't sit idle while Israeli violations against the prisoners are increasing, urging the international community to take serious action to save the prisoners' life.
We are holding Friday prayer here in front of the Red Cross to express our support to our prisoners who are a symbol of our Palestinian cause. We will always be proud of their patience. Our message to the Israeli regime is clear. We hold Israel responsible for the lives of our prisoners and we won't remain silent over these violations.
Palestinian detainees are passing through hard medical conditions as 15 inmates inside Israeli jails are diagnosed with cancer, while more than 200 others have lost their lives as a result of the Israeli systematic policy of medical negligence.
While hundreds of Palestinian detainees, including women and children, are subjected to inhumane violations of their rights inside Israeli jails, Palestinians here are paying efforts, demanding the international community to break its silence over the prisoners' issue. Roba Shabbat, Gaza.
Muslim pilgrims are marching toward Iraq's holy city of Karbala to mark Arbaeen. The pilgrims are arriving in the city to observe the 40th day after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. This year, Arbaeen falls on September the 28th. Prior to the pandemic, the event drew millions each year. But now, the Iraqi government has restricted the number of foreign pilgrims. It has allowed only 40,000 foreign visitors into the country, many of them Iranians. Imam Hussein and dozens of his companions were martyred during the Battle of Karbala with a tyrant of their time over 13 centuries ago. They were killed on the day of Ashura. Moving on, U.S. President Joe Biden has intensified his efforts to make pacts with Asia-Pacific countries in the face of a rising China. Biden sat down with the leaders of Australia, India, and Japan in the first in-person summit at the White House where they agreed for a stable and democratic Indo-Pacific. The leaders of the Quad group discussed regional challenges in a veiled dig at rival China, although it was not mentioned. They called the group a practical initiative to confront pressures and challenges. U.S. officials later stressed that the group is not a military alliance. China was quick to react, saying the bloc is doomed to fail. The Quad meeting marked another U.S. step to reviving its focus in diplomatic efforts after its recent controversial security pact with Australia. That move was also immediately denounced by China and France. Two Canadians detained in China on spying charges are released after Ottawa freed a top executive of Chinese communications giant Huawei, held in the country on U.S. fraud charges. The release of Huawei's Meng Wanzhou came after a deal with U.S. prosecutors to end a case against her. Meng had been fighting against extradition to the U.S. since she was arrested in Vancouver nearly 3 years ago. She was charged with misleading HSBC Bank on Huawei's dealings with Iran. Both Meng and the Chinese telecom giant dismissed the allegations. Meanwhile, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau announced two Canadians imprisoned in China were freed and headed home. The events have brought an abrupt end to legal and geopolitical wrangling that for the past 3 years roiled relations between Washington, Beijing, and Ottawa. United States closes a crowded refugee camp in Texas amid growing criticism over the mistreatment of the asylum seekers. In our news review program, we'll discuss the matter further with our guests. Take a listen.
And now welcome everyone up to the news review program where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. Now, USMT is a camp hosting thousands of refugees at Del Rio, Texas, amid growing criticism over the mistreatment of the asylum seekers there. 2,000 asylum seekers have been rapidly expelled to Haiti, while 8,000 others have chosen to return to Mexico. U.S. Department of Homeland Security will decide whether to expel the remaining 5,000 or to place them in immigration removal proceedings. Most of the asylum seekers were Haitians who have fled years of grinding poverty worsened by a recent devastating earthquake and a storm. The administration of President Joe Biden has come under growing criticism over its refugee policy, especially after the recent mistreatment of asylum seekers by U.S. border guards. Biden has tried to placate the anger by accepting responsibility.
Of course I take responsibility. I'm president, but it was horrible what to see, as you saw. To see people treated like they did, horses barely running over, people being strapped, it's outrageous.
The Biden administration faced condemnation at home and abroad after images showing Border Patrol agents on horseback whipping the refugees went viral on social media. The violent scenes have been likened to pictures of horse-mounted police, prison guards, or slave owners using whips against African Americans. And now joining us for the story is Colin Campbell from Washington, D.C., Amnesty for Life, Malcolm, civil rights activist and commentator, joining us from Tampa Bay, Florida. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome both of you to the program. Dr. Campbell, we're going to start with you to get the latest in this protracted story with respect to these Haitian refugees there at the Del Rio.
Well, you had thousands of Haitian migrants coming from South America through Colombia into up to the Del Rio, and that's where they were headed off by U.S. Border Patrol agents. And we saw the very chilling and disturbing video of these agents that were riding on horseback, yielding ropes that were used as whips. There were times when they would twirl these rope-like handles and they would strike people in the face, at least according to some of the video that we've seen. This caused outrage across the country from coming from many different organizations and people as these Haitian migrants, many of them looking for a better way of life after suffering many climactic issues and weather issues, and then the assassination of their president. So they are people who are fleeing from very dire circumstances. There are gangs in Haiti that have taken over certain areas, and of course the economy has never really been great, and it's even worse now because of all of the recent chaos and the imbroglio that they're experiencing. But what we've seen is a humanitarian crisis at the border, so much so that the Haitian delegate to the Haitian ambassador resigned from his position, Daniel Foote. This is all happening under a Biden administration, one that the president said that he was going to do what he could to help immigrants, a person who said that he would help people of color, and we're not really seeing this wholeheartedly. Now, what has happened is that we have seen and heard that there will be some Haitians that will be allowed to stay in the country, but many have already been deported by the thousands, and it is unclear how they're making that decision whether to keep certain Haitian migrants here or send them back to the island of Hispaniola.
Thank you, Colin. And Mr. Life, Malcolm, welcome to the program. Your initial thoughts on the treatment of these refugees there at the U.S. Southern border with Mexico?
Well, it's colonial U.S. business as usual. We have known for as long as the United States has been in existence, it has exploited African people, no matter where African people have been dispersed around the world by Europeans. The thing that is particular about Haiti, though, that often gets swept under the rug or under discussed, if ever discussed, is that Haiti was the first African colonized territory to claim its independence. And upon claiming its independence, Haiti, independence from white rule and colonial domination when it kicked the French Navy and Army in the rear and won their own independence and freedom and declared that any African who made it from the United States who was subject to chattel slavery at that time, any African who was able to get to Haiti had asylum there, and they also the Africans in Haiti also pledged to come to the United States and help Africans in the U.S. organize and free ourselves from colonial domination that we suffered then. And so it's no mystery why. And there's always this discussion, too, about Haiti being such a poor country and the economy is bad, but the economy just didn't become bad because the people mismanaged some money or something like that. After the people of Haiti, the Africans in Haiti, won their independence from colonial domination, they had to turn around and pay reparations, something like 900 million francs, or 90 million, so a whole lot of million francs, to the white people who had enslaved us in Haiti, and that and made Haiti a debtor nation from the beginning. So it's always been colonial domination that has been an impediment to African people all around the world in Haiti, and there's this special hatred for Africans in Haiti because of our ability to win our freedom then and our promise to help Africans all over the country, all over the U.S., win our freedom where we could if they could make it here. And so it's no secret why they want to send Africans from Haiti back, because Africans from Haiti bring a revolutionary spirit to the country, to the U.S., even though they may be seeking asylum. And I know my co-guest here, Colin, said that he's not really sure how they're deciding who to send back to Haiti, but what I've seen in some reports is that the Africans that are from Haiti, who some government officials are allowing to stay, are children malleable enough to be molded into sycophants and people who might believe that they're some kind of Haitian American even, but the African people who have the resistance and the resilience running through their veins from times past get shipped back right away.
Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us on the program. Stay safe, both of you. And farewell to you both. Colin Campbell there joining us from Washington, D.C., and Mr. Life Malcolm joining us from Tampa Bay, Florida. That's a wrap for this segment of your news review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
A U.S. Democratic lawmaker slams her own party's leadership for backing a bill that would allocate funds to Israel's so-called Iron Dome missile system. In an email to her constituents, House Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York slammed the congressional chamber for rushing to pass the $1 billion additional funding bill. She described the process as deeply unjust, as no debate was held before the vote on the bill. Ocasio-Cortez noted that the United States is already providing the regime with billions of dollars worth of military aid. The push was initially proposed in a motion aimed at providing emergency funds to avoid a U.S. government shutdown. It was later removed and proposed again as a standalone bill, which was passed in a 420-9 vote on Thursday.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
the supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. Oh, the most merciful.
In the limelight.
The costs and consequences of America's 21st century wars have by now been well documented. A staggering $8 trillion in expenditures and more than 380,000 civilian deaths, as calculated by Brown University's Cost of War project. The question of who has benefited most from the military spending, unfortunately, received far less attention. Dear listener, this was part of an article written by William D. Harting, writer. This article is published under the heading Corporate America Cashed In on Post-9/11 Pentagon Spending Surge. Stay tuned, please, for the second part of this article. The Afghan reconstruction process was similarly replete with examples of fraud, waste, and abuse. These included a U.S.-appointed economic task force that spent $43 million constructing a gas station essentially in the middle of nowhere that would never be used, another $150 million on lavish living quarters for U.S. economic advisors, and $3 million for Afghan police patrol boats that would prove similarly useless. Perhaps most disturbingly, a congressional investigation found that a significant portion of $2 billion worth of transportation contracts issued to U.S. and Afghan firms ended up as kickbacks to warlords and police officials or as payments to the Taliban to allow large convoys of trucks to pass through areas they controlled, sometimes as much as $1,500 per truck or up to $500,000 for each 300-truck convoy. In 2009, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton stated that one of the major sources of funding for the Taliban is the protection money paid from just such transportation contracts. A second stream of revenue for corporations tied to those wars went to private security contractors, some of which guarded U.S. facilities or critical infrastructure like Iraqi oil pipelines. The most notorious of them all was, of course, Blackwater. A number of whose employees were involved in a 2007 massacre of 17 Iraqis in Baghdad's Nisour Square. They opened fire on civilians at a crowded intersection while guarding a U.S. embassy convoy. The attack prompted ongoing legal and civil cases that continued into the Trump era, when several perpetrators of the massacre were pardoned by the president. In the wake of those killings, Blackwater was rebranded several times, first as XE Services and then as Academy, before eventually merging with the Triple Canopy, another private contracting firm. Blackwater founder Eric Prince then separated from the company, but he has since recruited private mercenaries on behalf of the United Arab Emirates for deployment to the civil war in Libya in violation of a United Nations arms embargo. Prince also unsuccessfully proposed to the Trump administration that he recruit a force of private contractors meant to be the backbone of the U.S. war effort in Afghanistan. Another task taken up by private firms Titan and CACI International was the interrogation of Iraqi prisoners. Both companies had interrogators and translators on the ground about Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq, a site where such prisoners were brutally tortured. The number of personnel deployed and the revenues received by security and reconstruction contractors grew dramatically as the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan wore on. The Congressional Research Service estimated that by March 2011, there were more contractor employees in Iraq and Afghanistan, that is about 155,000, than American uniformed military personnel, that is 145,000. In its August 2011 final report, the Commission on Wartime Contracting in Iraq and Afghanistan put the figure even higher, stating that contractors represent more than half of the U.S. presence in the contingency operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, and at times employing more than a quarter million people. While an armed contractor who had served in the Marines could earn as much as $200,000 annually in Iraq, about three-quarters of the contractor workforce there was made up of people from countries like Nepal or the Philippines or Iraqi citizens. Poorly paid, at times they received as little as $3,000 per year. A 2017 analysis by the Cost of War Project documented abysmal labor conditions and major human rights abuses inflicted on foreign nationals working on the U.S.-funded projects in Afghanistan, including false imprisonment, theft of wages, and death and injuries in areas of conflict. With the U.S. military in Iraq reduced to a relatively modest number of armed advisors and no American forces left in Afghanistan, such contractors are now seeking foreign clients. For example, a U.S. firm, Tire One Group, which was founded by a former employee of Blackwater, trained four of the Saudi operatives involved in the murder of Saudi journalist and U.S. resident Jamal Khashoggi, an effort funded by the Saudi regime. As the New York Times noted when it broke that story, such issues are likely to continue as American private military contractors increasingly look to foreign clients to shore up their business as the United States scales back overseas deployments after two decades of war. Adding one more factor to the two-decade so-called war on terror, explosion of corporate profits. Overseas arms sales also rose sharply in this era. The biggest and most controversial market for U.S. weaponry in recent years has been the West Asia-North Africa region, particularly sales to countries like Saudi Arabia and the UAE regimes, which have been involved in a devastating war in Yemen, as well as fueling conflicts elsewhere in the region. Donald Trump made the most noise about the West Asia arms sales and their benefits to U.S. economy. However, the giant weapons-producing corporations actually sold more weaponry to Saudi Arabia on average during the Obama administration, including three major offers in 2010 that totaled more than $60 billion for combat aircraft, attack helicopters, armored vehicles, bombs, missiles, and guns, virtually an entire arsenal. Many of those systems were used by the Saudis in their intervention in Yemen, which has now involved the killing of thousands of civilians in indiscriminate airstrikes and the imposition of a blockade that contributed substantially to the death of nearly a quarter of a million people to date. Reining in the excess profits of weapons contractors and preventing waste, fraud, and abuse by private firms involved in supporting U.S. military operations will ultimately require reduced spending on war and our preparations for war. So far, unfortunately, Pentagon budgets only continue to rise and yet more money flows to the big five weapons firms. To alter this remarkably unvarying pattern, a new strategy is needed, one that increases the role of American diplomacy while focusing on emerging and persistent non-military security challenges. National security needs to be redefined, not in terms of a new Cold War with China, but to forefront crucial issues like pandemics and climate change. It's time to put a halt to the direct and indirect foreign military interventions the United States regime has carried out in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Somalia, Yemen, and so many other places in this century. Otherwise, we are in for decades of more war profiteering by weapons contractors reaping massive profits with impunity.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
last day of the summer of 1980, on September the 22nd at 10 a.m., a report was received from Gilanetar, a provincial city located in the western border of Iran, about the bombing of Iranian territory by the regime of Saddam Hussein in Iraq. In the very early hours of the attack, it was not clear what had happened and what the exact scope of the attack was. At 1:30 p.m., reports of bombing reached Tehran from the western province of Ilam and the city of Dehlorom. 15 minutes later, Ahvaz reported the airport had been bombed. 5 minutes after Ahvaz, at 1:50 p.m., Kermanshah reported a similar attack. 5 minutes later, at exactly 1:55 p.m., Bushehr also reported that it had been bombed. At 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the Dezful Air Force Base was also bombed. There was panic and chaos in the corridors of the Air Force. Everyone was wondering what was going on. Eyewitnesses had seen olive-colored MiGs flying in the Iranian airspace and dropping bombs. Twenty minutes had passed since the bombing of the Dezful Air Force Base when the same olive-colored MiGs all appeared in the sky of Tehran. Black smoke rose from Mehrabad Airport. At that very moment, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei was waiting to talk to the factory workers at the General Factory near Mehrabad Airport. At that moment, Ayatollah Khamenei decided not to cancel his speech for the factory workers. He calmly went behind the podium and gave them heart. Until then, Ayatollah Khamenei was dressed as a cleric, the clothes he wore since he was a teenager. But he did not know that fate had prepared another garment for him as well. This is the story of the presence of the leader of the Islamic Revolution during the early years of the imposed war on Iran. A depiction of Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Husseini Khamenei in military uniform. February 8, 1979, a large number of Air Force personnel came to Alavi School wearing plain clothes. Once inside the school compound, they dressed in their military uniform. Imam Khomeini came and stood behind the window. The Air Force personnel rose their hands and showed their allegiance to the Imam by a military salute. This military salute signified the fact that they acknowledged Imam Khomeini as their new commander. Ayatollah Khamenei witnessed this historic moment, the moment that proved that the revolutionaries could trust and count on the army during the difficult days of the revolution. At 10 o'clock in the morning on the 11th of February 1979, just hours before the victory of the Islamic Revolution of Iran, when the army leader saw that defeat was imminent, the conflict between the people and the Shah's regime, they inevitably announced their neutrality. This meant that the revolution had gained victory. While Ayatollah Khamenei was talking to workers at the General Factory near Mehrabad Airport, the communists intended on hijacking the workers' union and labor movement. After the victory of the revolution, Major General Karani, one of the revolutionary commanders of the army, was appointed head of the Joint Staff of the Revolutionary Army. The future army now had to invest in young officers, and that took time. At times, left-wing groups such as Fadoyan Khalq guerrillas and the MKO blatantly called for the dissolution of the army. Imam Khomeini wanted the army to remain for the country and the revolution.
Ayatollah Khamenei also agreed with the point of view of the Imam regarding the army. He paid great attention to the issues regarding the army. The military was also surprised to see that a cleric was so well acquainted with army and military issues. Ayatollah Khamenei's experience in military issues dates back to his years in prison. The years when Ayatollah Khamenei was imprisoned in military jails alongside military men, and during the conversations that he had there with them, he learned about the inner workings and the atmosphere of the army. Ayatollah Khamenei's acquaintance with military affairs, in fact, had another side, i.e. the support of the revolutionary clergy for the army. Those days, Kurdistan was the hub for leftist and separatist groups. They would attack the barracks. Major General Qarani had ordered the army in Kurdistan to resist the attacks from the leftist and separatist groups. This was while the interim government, unlike the army, wanted to make concessions to the Kurdish separatists through negotiation and compromise. There was a lot of political pressure on Major General Qarani. During these difficult days, Ayatollah Khamenei met with Qarani. Shortly afterwards, and not long after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, a new military institution was created by the name of Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps. The military body was mainly created by the revolutionary youth who had a long history and great amount of experience fighting the Shah's regime. Youssef Kolahduz, one of the army officers who was himself among the founders of the IRGC, volunteered to join the force in order to participate in the training and organization of the IRGC forces. But for the IRGC to become a professional military organization, training was not enough. In the meeting of the Revolutionary Council on March the 27th, 1979, Ayatollah Khamenei raised various issues on behalf of Imam Khomeini, leader of the Islamic Revolution, so that this fledgling institution could turn into an official and professional organization. Especially since the Revolutionary Guards in Kurdistan had become the guardians of Iran's borders, fighting the separatists. With the immense pressure on Major General Qarani, Bazargan, head of Iran's interim government, eventually removed Qarani from his post as chief of the Joint Staff of the Army of the Islamic Republic. Shortly after this, the Forghan terrorist group, which had combined Islam values with Marxist ideology, assassinated Qarani. The Forghan group martyred Qarani at his residential home near Valiasr Square in the heart of Tehran. Qarani's brutal assassination was the first since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, and he became the first martyr in the history of the revolution, and after his martyrdom, he was given the rank of lieutenant general. He was laid to rest in the shrine of Lady Masume in Qom. Shortly after the martyrdom of General Qarani, the Forghan terrorist group assassinated Ayatollah Mutahhari, an influential figure in the Islamic Revolution and chairman of the Council of the Islamic Revolution. This made it absolutely clear to everyone that in the new battle, the clergy and the army are actually on the same front. On May the 22nd, 1979, Bazargan, the prime minister of the interim government, went to Qom to visit the Imam. During the meeting, the Imam expressed concern about some reports coming from the army. Bazargan decided to visit the Joint Army Headquarters. That same day, Ayatollah Khamenei is visiting the Joint Chiefs of Staff with Bazargan. This was Ayatollah Khamenei's first visit to the Joint Chiefs of Staff. There, he first met an intelligence army general, Brigadier General Falnohi. It was after this visit that Bazargan went to Qom again to report to the Imam. This time, Ayatollah Khamenei also attended the meeting with the Imam. It was decided that changes should be made to the army command. In the same meeting, the Imam made Ayatollah Khamenei his representative in the army. On May the 24th, 1979, Ayatollah Khamenei participated in the meeting of the Revolutionary Council to raise an important issue. He stated that those in high-ranking and leading positions in the revolution should pay more attention to the army. The Army should not be viewed with pessimism, and Army personnel must be kept within the Army institution. Ayatollah Khamenei also said there are a lot of brains and intellectual force in the Army, and it should be taken more seriously. Ayatollah Khamenei's full defense of the Army was a response to the words of groups such as the MKO, who wanted to dismantle the Army. Without the Army, their work would have been much easier. In mid-July 1979, Ayatollah Khamenei, with the decision of the Revolutionary Council, became the Deputy Minister of Revolutionary Affairs in the Ministry of Defense. In the summer of that same year, some individuals in the interim government had suggested that the country did not need advanced American weapons and that these weapons should be returned to the Americans and the money gained from their return should be used to build the country. Ayatollah Khamenei was fully aware of both the armed movements of the terrorist groups inside the country and the separatist wars in the border provinces, as well as the military movements made by Iraq's Ba'athist regime on the borders with Iran. On August 13, 1979, Ayatollah Khamenei finally issued an important announcement. From that point on, it was proclaimed that any cancellation or signing of contracts must be coordinated by the Deputy Minister of Revolutionary Affairs of the Ministry of Defense. This decision forever removed the idea of returning the advanced weapons from the interim government's agenda. Ayatollah Khamenei, as the Imam's representative in the Army and Deputy for Revolutionary Affairs at the Ministry of Defense, had several other plans and strategies on mind, the first of which was the formation of an ideological political bureau, which later became one of the main pillars of the Army and officially called Ideological Political Organization. One of the most important steps that Ayatollah Khamenei took for the welfare of the Army families was to prevent the closure of Etka chain stores, which provided services to military personnel and their families. But perhaps nothing was as important as starting the program for the military self-sufficiency. During the Shah's regime, the Army had about 200,000 personnel. But in addition to that, there were 50,000 U.S. military advisors stationed in Iran as well. That means there was one American soldier for every four Iranian soldiers. The repair and maintenance of advanced military equipment of the Iranian army were all in the hands of the Americans, and the Iranians did not have much authority in it. The economic rationale behind it was quite clear for Americans. The more advisors and the more dependence Iran had for these advisors simply meant more money for the Americans. The United States not only sold weapons, but also got paid to repair them, creating jobs for its 50,000 troops in Iran. At the same time, the technological secrets of its military equipment were kept to themselves, and the Iranians were unaware of the technical issues behind the equipment. This situation continued even after the Islamic Revolution in 1979, but finally, when Taghir Yahi resigned from the Ministry of Defense on September the 19th of 1979, and Dr. Chamron took the helm of the Defense Ministry, the dismissal of U.S. military advisors was accelerated. Now the main issue was the self-sufficiency of the Army.
Holy Defense, a Mirror of Ashura. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. The 8-year imposed war of the 1980s was full of epic scenes, and as the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has said, it is an unending treasury for the Iranian nation. However, the role of women in that unforgettable period was as much important and determining as that of men. Women as mothers, sisters, and wives played a very great role in setting the ground for men's best presence in the battlefields. Women proved that, like the women of the first years of Islam, shoulder to shoulder with men, they served as preparatory and supportive forces behind the fronts. Although some of them also helped the combatants in the battlefields as nurses and medical staff, the Iranian women took Lady Zainab as the role model. Zainab, the sister of Imam Hussein, did her best to support the brothers' uprising. Her main role was seen after the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, in the position of the messenger of the uprising to continue the effect of the bloods of martyrs. However, during the heat of the war too, Zainab made every effort to accompany Imam Hussein. When her nephew Ali Akbar plunged in his blood, Zainab tried to strengthen Imam Hussein's morale. This also happened at the martyrdom of Qasim, the son of Imam Hassan, peace upon him. Yet, when Lady Zainab's own sons, Own and Muhammad, were martyred, she didn't come out of the tent not to embarrass him. She told herself, "These were two small gifts to God, so it is not good to go to my sons and cause pain to Hussein's heart with crying and moaning." But she looks through the tent that Hussein dismounts and hugs his nephews. It is very hard for mothers to tolerate the loss of children. The mothers of martyrs of the eight-year imposed war followed Lady Zainab, peace upon her, and patiently tolerated this great pain. Upon hearing the news of their son's martyrdom, these great ladies would thank God and ask him to accept their sacrifice. Many of these mothers would bury their sons themselves. Rawabeh Fallahzadeh, the mother of three martyrs, said, "I am not upset at the martyrdom of my sons, but the only thing that I want from the youth and the people is to continue the path of martyrs and do not do anything that does not please God." Ummul Banin, the wife of Imam Ali, after the martyrdom of Lady Fatimatu Zahra, peace upon her, sent his four sons with Imam Hussein, peace upon him, to the field of Karbala. She emphasized that they should never let the grandson of the Prophet be lonely. After the event of Ashura, she was very worried, and she faced a man called Bashir who was coming from Karbala. She asked him, "What's happened?" He said, "Your Abbas was martyred." She asked again, "What news do you have?" He answered, "Your other sons, Abdullah, Usman, and Ja'far, were also martyred." Ummul Banin inquired him for the third time with these words, "Speak to me of Hussein. May all my children and whatever there is under this sky be sacrificed for Hussein. Tell me, what about Hussein?" Then Bashir said that Hussein was also martyred. At that moment, Ummul Banin moaned very painfully and hugged her knees sadly. Thank you. women followed the role models of great ladies like Zainab and Umm al-Banin during the Islamic Revolution and the Holy Defense. These mothers didn't think for a single moment that they might lose their sons. Many of these ladies encouraged their sons to go to the front to obey the command of Imam Khomeini. Imam Khomeini, in several occasions during the struggles of the Islamic Revolution and the 8-year imposed war, stressed that the role of women in the formation and victory of the revolution and the victory of the Iranian nation in the war was even more important than that of men. Ayatollah Khamenei said on the role of mothers, of martyrs, the mother of two martyrs, the mother of three martyrs, the mother of four martyrs is not a joke. This is easy to say. When our child catches cold and coughs, how much are we worried? One's child goes and is killed. The second one goes and is killed. The third one goes and is killed. Is this a joke? And this mother, with the very proper motherly emotions that are gushing forth, plays such a role that she persuades 100 other mothers to send their children to the war. If these mothers would moan and whine when their son's body comes or even doesn't come, complain, protest against the imam and the war, then the war would certainly be paralyzed in the very first years and the first phase. This is the role of martyrs, mothers.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing. I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran, all big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. Today's program is Islamic Upbringing, wherein we discuss problems, issues, and other questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children.